So we should start by just going around the table and have everyone, well, maybe introduce very quickly what you have in mind or what you've been thinking about, and then we can come back and we discuss some of these things in more detail. So one of the things, I mean, first of all, since we're all doing research, one of the things that we need to do on a continuous basis is to keep thinking about how to, you know, extend what we're doing in new directions, right? That's in fact really, really important for us to be able to identify new directions to work on. And I mean, after you graduate, you'll have to continue doing that. Ideally, you should continue doing that. So what I'm, you know, the message I have is that as you're working on your projects, no matter what you're doing, do keep thinking about other directions. It's really important. So Leonardo, do you want to get started?
Sure. Although I don't have anything to share at the moment, unfortunately. I've been so immersed in what I'm doing lately that I haven't thought about anything.
But it doesn't have to be lately. It has to be something that you might have thought about 3 months ago or 6 months ago, right? I think the key is to be aware that this is really important. I mean, besides what you're working on a day-to-day basis, is to spend time, you know, take out time. I'm not saying that you must come up with something creative, right, every 3 months or so, but at the very minimum, we have to take out time to do this activity, right, engage ourselves in exploring new directions. And something, you might surprise yourself and come up with something that you really, you know, get passionate about, and then, you know, that's what you pursue for your thesis.
It seems like even in one of my classes, I'm taking graph theory right now and I'm trying to see how can I apply this to what I'm doing in the lab. And I'm learning all these things about Eulerian circuits and finding ways to visit all edges in a graph. Well, still thinking about that. But I was thinking, right now at the moment, something more feasible would be like, you know, about random IO scheduling.
Okay.
So I was thinking of trying something like seeing how scheduling requests are random affect different devices or machines. You know what I mean?
So can you say a little bit more about that? I mean, what do you mean by random IO scheduling? And
well, typically, requests you want to, you do all this merging and sorting and everything. I mean, I don't know. This probably has been tried many times. So
that's okay. I think some of our most successful projects have been obvious ideas.
So I wanted to do something like some sort of test different variation in randomizing the IOs.
Okay, so we'll come back to that. Let's go around the tables to get something from each person, and then we can do one more round.
Well, one thing I've been thinking about is more rich requests algorithms for caching, like replacing and using information about latency of accesses and about latency of file evictions, for example. Usually you're just based on hits and misses, but not all hits are the same, not all misses are the same, not all the evictions are the same. And I found a couple of papers that do some very basic latency based replacement, but it's very simple, very basic, and I thought of cases where it might not work, and I couldn't find anything for evictions, for example. It would be nice to do a reconsider life chance, and we could even generalize even more and treat the cases like, you know, order addictions and things like that. Basically, I was thinking of that direction. And another direction was related to my dissertation topic, and some new, you know, optimizations I can work on. And for example, there are lots of open things. For example, the duplication of the cache, of the upper cache layers, and about partitioning, and about scheduling. There are many different things I could work on, and that my dissertation can open. So those are the two directions. And I guess later, detail a bit more about this.
Okay, sounds good. Sajeev?
I've done some incremental thinking. I mean, those I already mentioned. Like, few of the things, like, one is the cost platform prediction, the performance prediction model. So, I was looking at some of the papers we already discussed, actually, the HP paper on the cost platform prediction, like, how you can transfer performance model built in one type of computer to another type of computer. So, I was thinking, like, a more basic, instead of going through like detailed like cache miss rate or all those details, so instead of going at lower levels, how do you calculate cross performance prediction on a more higher level data? Like,
by the way, about that, I always thought about you need to go into those details, and that's my theory, right? You need to consider caches. I always thought about what you're doing. I mean, because there are many cases in which having all the cash for you or not having can make a lot of difference.
No, you look at the higher level details. I'm talking about you look at the specification sheet of the of different types of computers and infer your performance result based on those specification sheets.
But I mean, what detail does this specification have to have?
Like your processor speed, the bus speed, the memory bus speed, also the cache, the CPU cache size.
Oh yeah, that's what I was saying. You need cache.
Yeah.
Hmm. But is there a contention component there or?
No, contention component is not, I don't think it's part of cross-platform prediction. It's a different problem.
There have been a lot of people working on cross-platform prediction, by the way.
I think right. Only the one very good paper on the HP lab, $1 from 50 cents or something like that.
Hmm.
So they have done it with just building sub-models on each component and merging each component together when predicting the performance of the application.
Yeah, but I mean, if I'm not mistaken, there's probably more out there in terms of cross-platform prediction where there is no contention involved. This is just, okay, you run it on one machine, single workload, and then predict the performance when that single workload runs on another machine without any contention, right, in both cases. I think there has been quite a bit of work done in that direction.
But I have to look like if they encounter all the possible changes in the machine you can have. Like probably they only, as I know, am I aware of, they probably look at the processor speed and also on the CPU cache size. But there could be something more fundamental unless we run and see the results.
Right. If there is something more fundamental, there has to be intuition behind it, right? If there is no contention, you have your storage could change and you could have latency based.
But since in our model we are thinking of latency, then I don't think changing storage would change the model.
It won't change the model, but you can still predict the performance.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the question is how we don't take into account, or at least your work so far doesn't take into account cache sizes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we bring that in? That would be something new. And, Okay. So, by the way, I mean, it's also important to think beyond what you're currently working on, which might be your thesis or your current project. Because there are lots and lots of questions, right, out there in systems. I mean, especially with the changing technology, you know, several of the design decisions that OSs make need to be revisited, right, would possibly benefit from revisiting, right? And the way I see a thesis is, at least for, let's say, the first half of your PhD, it's very evolving in nature. And as you reach some kind of a midpoint, then, you know, things become more solidified. But until then, there is a lot of flexibility in what you could work on. So, it's, you know, bear in mind that, you know, there are no restrictions or limitations as to the kinds of things that you could possibly do regardless of what you're currently working on, right? And even for people who are later on in their PhD, you want to think about other possible directions, because you know, those are directions that you may end up pursuing in your new role at in your new job, right? So yeah, I mean, I guess the message is don't feel restricted by the current set of questions that you're considering. Feel free to branch out and explore other directions. It's very unlikely that what you're working on now for your PhD or your current research is going to be what you're going to be working on 5 or 10 years from now. That you might be doing very different things. But for you to be able to do those many, you know, very interesting things that are different, you have to, you know, be continuously thinking about all the possibilities out there. Right?
Well, for me, I have the same problem trying to find something. But I have this idea, not any solid idea, but I was thinking on MPIIO, that is supposed to let several compute nodes do I/O in an efficient way. As I understand how it works, it just aggregates the I/O and small amount of nodes will do the I/O for a bigger amount of nodes that should do the I/O if they were not using MPIIO. So as I understand, they just write to a regular file system or whatever file system is in the storage end. But I don't know how it would be useful to insert it. Just not to talk to a file system, just to talk directly to the devices and put SSDs in some parts of the communication to try to enhance this write. Instead of just using a file system in the backend, try to make MPIIO to use different devices to do it better. But that's all I got.
So there must be some reason for why you thought of this, right? So do you see any problems with the current way things are done?
Well, no, the thing that I saw this is because this PLFS that they did in Los Alamos, what they do was, instead of changing MPIIO, they try to fix the file system that MPIIO is used to make it work better. But you might want to change MPIIO instead of the backend to try to do something better, if it's possible, I'm sure. But I might be misinterpreting what they did. But as I understood, what they do was to change a file system that was optimized for the distributed computation. And then MPIIO just used that file system to store whatever they were writing. But implementation of MPIAO was saying.
Okay, so it seems like you started on some direction, right? So what I would suggest for you to do is to try to move to the next stage, which is, okay, now that you've identified some sort of a domain, completely understand the current contribution, right, which is MPIAO versus this PLFS, and understand why PLFS was proposed at a more deeper level, right? What is the real problem that it solves, and if it creates any new ones, and look at MPIAO and see what are the advantages and disadvantages, and see if there are any weaknesses in either class of these solutions and what those are, right? You can identify these by investigating these individual solutions more carefully and deeply, right? You might also want to look at some of the workload characterization studies to see what kind of workloads there are for these sorts of systems. I think recently there have been some workload characterization studies, especially from Argonne National Lab. Right, so you can look at that. I think the MSST paper also had, MSST, one of the papers we reviewed also had some characterization of workloads. And so you could look at that study, for instance, to see how these sorts of workloads would map to some of these optimizations. And that could be one way to take it to the next level, where you would actually come up with something that you feel is a better choice of design for a system like that. So it's good you've at least identified the domain as well as possible sub problem that you might want to further spend time on. Right, so
I'm not sure if this is long, but I don't know if they cache anything in the IO nodes. To write them to something in those nodes before sending to the
process. Well, you want to look at this burst buffer study, right, which I think we reviewed that for one of the conferences recently, maybe MSST, where they suggested that IO nodes should have these SSD buffers that would be written to very quickly during checkpoint time, but then once they are written, the application can continue, and in parallel,
yeah, I remember that.
The data gets written back to the file system, right? So that's the buffering approach exists, or at least has been proposed, and Gary Grider has been talking about this for 3 years now. It's just that they wrote a paper very recently about it. And they did some kind of a simulation study to evaluate how useful and it would be in practice, right, with some workloads. So you could take a look at that and see if that matches towards your thinking and how. Okay, good. Welcome back. We already went around the table, so you were just in time.
I see.
But we did just very quick introduction to what you have in mind, and then we can come back and do another one.
I see. Actually, I was thinking that I don't have any idea right now.
Mm.
I guess it has been a long time since I reviewed some papers.
Mm.
And at this point, I'm not.
You have this idea you mentioned me the other day, and you were thinking of writing a mail.
A what?
I don't remember, but you said you called me. I have this idea. Remember? Like a couple of weeks ago.
That happens a lot.
Those are the
talk about one of those.
Yeah, I guess there was something. The one I remember was something about kind of hybrid memory on a hypervisor instead of the operating system itself. And I think we talked about that already at some point. But what I was thinking is that probably hybrid memory would have would make more sense in a virtualized environment that is usually used in data centers, right? I think I read some statistic that said that most of the servers that are running now are running on a virtualized environment. So probably makes sense to rethink hybrid memory, which was targeted to servers, to run on a virtualized environment. I think that was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So
would it be different?
It would be a little bit different because now.
Well, you might want to just introduce hybrid memory very quickly for some people here may not even be aware of that.
Okay, so the idea of hybrid memory, first the target is to save power. And the way we were trying to do that is to reduce the amount of RAM. It turns out that RAM is consuming a big chunk of all the power in a server. And as the memory becomes bigger, the consumption of the power becomes linearly bigger, right? And that means that as the memory increases, the power will also increase, which is the trend, right? Increase more and more memory. CPU, you know, I guess CPU was the most consuming. Memory is now becoming the new, more consuming component, right? So the idea was to, there are some pages that are frequently used, but these pages are not really utilizing the whole bandwidth of the memory, the RAM. However, they are not, their frequency of access is not low enough to go to disk, right? Now, what he thought is that, okay, then we can remove some of the RAM that is holding these pages and put these pages in a flash, right? So now we have like a three-tier virtual memory system. And the idea was to make this transparent to the user space, and I was thinking even to the kernel itself. Right, so the idea was to implement this kind of system in a real operating system, but I have had some problems there. I guess that's an important
one question. Every time the application or device tries to access one of those pages in the SSD, it needs to be moved to memory.
True.
Before and moved back.
Yes. It doesn't need to be moved back, but it's just a replacement. Like something needs to move back.
And it happens in a transparent way to the application.
It happens in a transparent way to the application as well as the operating system.
So what's the difference between that and just using SSD as a swap?
As a swap. I guess one of the differences is that the swap is used only for anonymous pages. And pages in the kernel itself are not followed in the swap.
Is there any
right.
hardware limitation?
What was that?
The ones in the kernel, the
page cache.
Yeah, think of the page cache.
The page cache, okay. What's the thing that you mentioned?
That's what I said.
Oh.
Just the page cache.
But if your files are in the SSD, it would be the same.
Right, but that's not true. I mean, your files are never in the SSD in a server because SSDs are first, they are not cheap. And second, they're not big enough, right, to hold all their files. If that is the case, then I agree. I mean, it doesn't make sense to have hybrid memory. You just need to reduce the RAM, and that's it, right?
But what about a different abstraction? The SSD used for a lot of stages, a swap, and cache.
A cache. True.
What would be the difference between this abstraction and in hybrid memory.
Right. The only difference in that case would be that in the one you're talking about, you have a hard limit on both cases. You say, I want half of the SSD, for instance, half of the SSD for anonymous, half of the SSD for file. But now, if you're not using some space in the swap,
let's say you cannot upsize.
Dynamically?
Yes.
There
was something more that we discussed, I think, something more fundamental. At least, I remember, I always had this doubt, and once we had a discussion, and you said something to me that convinced me, and I said, oh, okay, so I remember the answer, but I don't remember what it was.
I see. Yeah. No, I guess if you make that dynamic, then I don't see, at least I don't remember any other advantages.
The question is the cache write through or write back? And is it persistent? Those are the kinds of questions I would ask.
I see.
Okay.
Is it persistent, I guess?
In hybrid memory, anything is persistent, right?
Well,
no.
Things don't need to be persistent. And even though they're not persistent in SSD, it doesn't matter because that's what would happen in a system with that amount of
RAM. Yeah, that's the thing.
The thing is that...
We don't have to be consistent. We don't have to be persistent.
To make it persistent, I mean, we don't need a persistent mapping. If the system crashes in the middle of something, whatever was in the SSD, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Right?
But why did you have a cache that is right?
Because that changes the semantics. Before, after the cache, for the OS, the cache is the storage. On hybrid memory, this is not part of the storage. This is part of the memory.
So where are you?
So that the thing is that you're not losing anything. You're doing pretty much whatever was being done before.
So what you're saying that if the OS writes to the cache, it believes that it's read persistent.
Exactly, yes. In this case, it doesn't have to, because it thinks it's part of its memory.
What will let it do the CPU fetches memory?
One line. 128 bytes.
128 bytes. Will it be possible to fetch memory directly from SSD?
No.
Why not?
Because the SSD is exported as a normal disk.
Yes.
Right? So
why do we change that?
Modify that.
Because if we do that, then we can put SSD at the same level of the memory and then trigger the entrenching of memory.
True. We thought about that. And that should be possible, but I think the hardware doesn't exist yet.
That's what NVRAM wants, right?
Yes.
The flash access granularity is large. You can read and write only in the granularity of pages, which is 2 kilobytes or something like that. So even if you put it at the same granularity of memory,
In the lowest granularity,
it's going to be 2 kilobytes of access, which is something that you cannot handle. So you would have to move data from flash to memory so that the CPU can access it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. What? But the ROM can be accessed.
Yes,
in the
bytes.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah,
it's much more expensive.
Oh yeah.
What?
This is why there is
work.
Really tiny.
Okay.
Yeah, that's cache look size and the granularity for my system.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that what we...
It would be important to contrast write-through caching with hybrid memory.
Yeah.
What are the pros and cons in terms of durability and performance?
Why do we always say, I mean, I think that's a valid question. I mean, thinking about what would happen if we had this type of hardware, right? And that's some direction.
People are already doing it. People have already
written a lot of I'm not talking about this specific case. I'm talking about, in general, we always say, yeah, we cannot do it because we don't have the hardware. We never took the direction of saying, well, what if we had this hardware? And that could, you know, we could publish in something like, well, is it ASPO? No, the program.
Architecture
support for
something. And I've done that before, and I've with very bad.
So so it's not a good idea doing that way.
At least I'm not very enthusiastic.
No, 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 but you're talking about the scenes, names,
yeah,
thing, right? No, no, but that's some hardware that was planning to,
yeah,
to come into the market. I'm thinking about completely different hardware that doesn't even exist and propose the new hardware and how to use it.
And how to build it. You had to first propose how to build it.
No, no, no.
Not necessarily, right?
Something like, if we add these instructions to the CPU,
something like that,
all applications in the world will reduce half of the time.
Yeah.
Well, if you can, if it's a CPU instruction and you talk about adding a new CPU instruction with justification as to how that can be implemented and what kind of improvement it's going to provide, then sure. But if it's a new storage device and you're claiming performance properties, reliability properties, granularity of access, then you better tell me what it's going to be.
For example,
you
making the SSD, the flash, byte addressable.
And that already
you have that, why not?
That already exists. NOR flash does it. It's just too expensive. Right, NOR flash is byte addressable. That's the ROM that you have on each motherboard.
Yeah.
It's just too expensive to manufacture.
But let's say it makes all the performance difference in the world. Like, at least some study that's saying that it can be useful.
Can be. Or it can be completely useless because it never happens.
Yeah.
Okay. I would,
but isn't that always a risk? Our research?
No, it's not. I mean, the stuff that you're doing right now, there is no risk. I mean, technology already exists. All we are doing is showing, okay, how can you use it differently? And in doing so, we show how to do a better job of using existing technology.
Right, but we may not do it in a way that with a performance that it's better than the current technology.
What?
We're doing something in a different way, right? And we're solving some issues, some problems that are related to doing it that way. But if the solution that we propose doesn't have an adequate performance, people are not going to adopt that solution. So that's the risk, right? It may be different, but there's always a risk in research.
Yeah, there is always a risk in research, for sure. But what you're talking about is a different kind of risk altogether. So
yes.
If I say, oh, here's a hypothetical technology, and here's a whole bunch of research that assumes that this technology exists, and there's no trace of it yet, right? You have to have a very good reason to believe that the technology is going to show up pretty soon, and no other technology is going to, say, exceed whatever properties it provides during this time frame. Right? There are lots of assumptions built into that sort of research, and I personally feel that's a lot more risky than the former kind, where
yeah,
we have an existing technology and
I think it's double. I mean, you have both risks, so
pioneer
more risks, of course.
Yeah, some people are doing that sort of research, and they do get published, and they do get cited because other people are also making the same assumption, right? And then there's a whole bunch of research. I was part of that kind of similar kind of process.
Kind of starts the chain.
There's a whole bunch of people who worked on this technology, which never showed up, and all that work hopefully is going to be useful at some point in the future, but very likely none of it is ever going to, you know, be useful.
It's like all that is holding on a thread. That's it.
Yeah.
And everything goes down.
Yeah. And you hope that at some point a new thread will actually make all of this viable, right?
Right.
And then you're going to be the old man on the conference when a new student is going to be talking about, no, and then we do, I recommend you read this paper from 8 years ago.
Doesn't that happen? Yeah, it does happen. Yeah, but I don't want to wait 30 years to speak up at a conference, right?
Yeah,
and no. for that you need to be in a position like I am, like tenured faculty, and I can relax for 30 years and then wait for one fine day when that happens. Go and tell people that, okay, you know, you should go and read that. Some we've already done this for you, you know. I don't think that's a very wise line of thinking, and because I've already been there, I've experienced it firsthand, and I think it's just too risky. I'd much rather have other people take that risk. And if it pays off for them, very good. But then for every risk that pays off, there are probably 100 people who failed. And you use and you lose a whole bunch of time on it, right? You lose 3, 4, 5 years. It's not good.
Your final dissertation was online, right?
Yeah, mostly.
I saw this paper some time ago about this guy who built, or at least had a prototype for managing GPUs. That I found really interesting, an idea that would be really cool. It was basically building the infrastructure to use GPUs in a different way.
Is that the one, the P-Task paper
yes.
that we read?
Yes, that one.
Yeah.
Something like that would be really cool. Because it's an existing hardware infrastructure that has been there for a long time and nobody has used it in a better way.
Yeah, there's another paper that was published at FAST. From Akshat's group. Mm-hmm. Akshat was part of that paper about how to do this deduplication related processing on GPU, identifying chunks and that was as fast.
And what about compression?
They didn't talk about compression there, but there's another paper now in that's going to be published in not MSST, there's this conference called SysStore that I was reviewing for, called the GPU Store. They have a paper called
How about parity calculation?
GPU Store. And they are actually, they are providing a kernel level interface for using GPUs. Of the PTASC and Akshat and this paper, I think this is probably the most interesting. And unfortunately, they chose to send the paper to SysStore. The funny thing is that they sent this to FAST. And there was some review. I didn't review that paper. But I was in that discussion. And I hadn't read that paper at that time. And during that discussion, one of the reviewers said, I got this other review from this from someone else who said that, well, the PTAS paper is better than this paper, and they published it already.
And does that kill it?
Just killed that, this paper. Now, when I read it, actually, for the SysStore conference, you can see that this paper is very different than the PTAS paper.
Not cool.
Not cool. These guys are probably really mad, right? And that happens in conferences. I mean, you just need some, and everyone else is not an expert. They hadn't read the PTAS paper either. The other people who read this paper, and they said, oh yeah, that paper looks very, looks very good. It was published in SOSP, and they've already published it, so why should we publish this other paper? So, yeah, I mean, now they're going to publish it in SysStore.
Do you know any paper on parity calculation with GPUs?
This paper has a lot of things,
uh-huh.
Encoding, encryption, okay. Lots of things that they evaluate.
Christian, about the duplication paper from Akshat, the trick is use GPUs for making quick hash calculations, that's the trick?
Something along those lines, yeah.
Because it's more powerful, that's it? It's more adequate for doing stuff in big
parallel.
Mm.
Yeah, I guess, so you're saying that this paper could have something like that, because it seems like for parity calculation you need one core for every stripe, full stripe. So if you have many writes, then you could parallelize parity calculation for all stripes in access.
So they proposed a new hashing algorithm, or they just showed how to implement, how to write?
I may be completely wrong about this, but I don't think it was much about hashing at all.
Because that was,
it was
that
more
was
about
our problem. For
it was
for
more
hash.
About how to detect chunk boundaries and things like that. This is variable
oh.
side chunking.
Okay, so it's not block align the duplication, they can do this flexible,
yeah,
not align thing.
Yeah, something.
And
like
that's for primary storage?
I don't think they, I don't
remember. It has to be backup.
I don't remember, yeah.
So, why don't solutions don't compress after dedupe?
After dedupe? They could. I don't think any of them talks about not compressing.
You
just don't talk about compression at all.
There is a paper on that. I remember a Microsoft paper. They talk about, you know, all the options: compression only, deduplication only, or compression and after duplication, deduplication and after compression. And they show that the best combination is deduplication and then compression.
There is also a system that does that. It's called the system. Because if that is the case, that could take advantage of GPUs for doing all of that.
So this GPU store actually talks about
flexible interface to manage your GPU. Something like BorderFS would take advantage of that, right?
To calculate checksums?
Right, so
yeah.
For instance, a PTask provides an interface or infrastructure for applications to use GPUs. This one provides infrastructure for kernel to use GPUs.
Mm.
And so that's there's a big difference there.
Right.
So that could be something to do, right? I mean, for example, BorderFS, it's extremely slow. How to use GPU for make it quicker?
To calculate checksums.
Where is that?
Yes.
And then the CPU is the bottleneck, because whenever you do something heavy on BorderFS, your CPU is always 100%.
Hmm.
That could be something.
But are you sure it's the checksum calculation that is taking all the CPU?
I'm doing a find.
Find?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because I think for every read, it checks the...
It checks for every
checksum.
Block, it checksums and compares checksums.
Of course.
Okay, I forgot to do the checksum again.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, it has to calculate a checksum for a page.
Yeah.
Well,
a checksum is a hash, and...
But I guess my question is, how is the time to calculate a checksum compared to the time of bringing that page into memory?
You have to bring it
in. Pipeline it. You can pipeline that process.
You have to bring it in memory,
okay,
but,
let's say
but if it's 1 nanosecond, I'm
yeah,
saying that if it's 1 nanosecond,
yeah,
it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah,
the
from this, it's not that comparable, but could be the time as of SSD access.
Okay, that's true. Yeah, that
And I remember in class, I had exactly that question, you remember?
Yeah.
Because some guy said, you know, that hashing time that you have is not that much, but if you compare it to an SSD access, it's actually the same. So
you said you got that question.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
to use a GPU, then you need to also move the page to the memory.
Oh, no, we're
GPU.
Not saying anything about not reducing the I/O access, but if you have the I/O access plus doubling it for checksum,
not only that, you're also using the CPU that can be used for something
yes.
else.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is that maybe using the GPU don't give you less latency.
It won't give you less latency? Certainly, but now applications can draw in the CPU.
No, it would
give
you less latency, because before saying to the application, here's your page, you have to check something.
Yes. What I'm saying is that maybe
the
time
the case.
Will take
yeah, but
more
the
time
case,
in the
let's
GPU.
Say you reduce it to zero. Let's
maybe
say the GPU is the more magical device
yes.
on
the
unit.
The
yeah,
thing
but
is with
not,
the GPU,
right?
Yeah, yeah, but let's say you reduce it to half. You have 3/4
but
of the
I don't
time.
Think you reduce it by half. The point is that
you might not reduce
it. The GPU is very highly parallel, but I don't think it's faster than the CPU.
No,
and it has this problem that you need to move all the data that it would
oh,
use.
I see.
And that could take more time than using the CPU directly.
Okay, but for start, everything has trade-offs, right? We have to find some nice, sweet
yeah.
trade-offs. Nothing comes for free.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So if you want to be negative about something, you can't be negative about everything in the universe.
No,
you
no,
have
but
to find
the point of being negative is to find the solutions and then have a paper on
yeah, it. I think it's called constructive criticism, right? that's really important, is to be constructively criticizing instead of saying, okay, but this is bad and this is bad and this is bad. After, and this is really important when you write reviews. Okay, for papers, for instance, say, okay, this is a big problem. After saying that this is a big problem, you have to say something along. How about this? How about trying this instead? If you don't have that second part, then you're not thinking like a, you know, researcher. You're just thinking like someone who's an analyst, right? Who just analyzes things and figures out if they're good or bad, right? If you want to be a researcher, you have to do constructive criticism all the time. You have to sort of train your brain in thinking like that. So you say, okay, I'm good at finding what the current problems are, but also I'm good at figuring out ways around it to achieve the same goal. It's really important.
I see. But not all the time you have the solution, right?
You don't have it, but what I'm saying is that before you step up to criticize, spend some time to see if there is that, you know, constructive feedback possible, right? Because oftentimes, you know, the criticism is not as important as the part that follows it. Because you may be absolutely right about the criticism, but you don't get much out of that. What you get is out of the next step, right? How are you trying to work around that and solving something, right? Because that's how you get new research directions. I'm not saying that you shouldn't criticize. You should be very, very critical in your thinking. Absolutely. It's really important. But keep that other thing also in mind. So the other directions that you could, you know, start thinking about is what I said earlier. So when you have new technology, and you also know that existing systems are designed for old technology, how would you go about, you know, evaluating if the current designs are the best designs and whether they can be applied to new technology or not, or do you have to do something different? To give you a concrete example, I don't know if you remember this paper that was in FAST on flash I/O scheduling. That was along those lines, right? So they said, okay, flash is a new device. I/O schedulers have been built for this. Do we need to rethink I/O schedulers?
There is a paper about that.
It's a really, really interesting paper.
I haven't read that one.
Yeah.
Although I have been thinking about that for a long
time. Yeah. And it's a paper and a set of ideas that anyone could have, let's say, thought of,
mm-hmm.
if they spent enough time thinking about it.
Right.
And that's when those are the kinds of papers saying we could have done that, right? And or we should have done that. But the truth is that, no, we were thinking about other things. We were spending time doing other things. And that's an example of
how,
this. How
is the paper called?
It's called Flash I/O Schedule. That's it.
Along those lines, that's it. Because when you think about that, for instance, I was reading about the block layer lately, and the design that Linux kernel has in the block layer is supposed to be flexible enough to take that into account. The whole idea of the schedule is that the main difference between a cartridge device and a block device is that in the block device you want to buffer your request before you send, as opposed to send one at a time, you buffer them and then you send a bunch of them. And then you reorganize things like that so that your disk has a better performance. But it doesn't have to be like that. You just can send one at a time in the case of the flash, and then you don't suffer the penalty of buffering or scheduling.
That's
no scheduling.
That does make sense, but they raise a whole bunch of new issues. For instance, the read-write imbalance in performance, which didn't exist earlier with disk.
Right.
Writes with flash are very different than reads. And what does that mean for I/O scheduling? Right?
The ramification.
The ramifications of that.
Right, the ramification.
Yeah, the performance of writes is very different than reads because of things like write amplification, garbage collection that it introduces, and so on, right?
But one easy solution is just to give priority to reads by the probability, by the ratio of
how do you do it, right? They do that in the paper. So it's something that even you could have done, right? So when you look at the paper, you feel like you could have done it, but they actually do it and they show what is the impact of doing it. Like they evaluate that.
That's how they both pay.
Right? So a lot of times when you read these sorts of papers, you say, oh, this is very simple and, you know, it's obvious. But a lot of times the most important ideas are very simple. And people adopt it immediately because they see the simplicity of it and they see the impact that it brings. Right? It's important to revisit conventional designs that have been done for previous era technology and see whether you need to change them somehow.
Well, what about this idea of having, for example, team guests, right, that don't do any caching, any scheduling, any nothing?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be better to have, for example, you usually have your guests with no IO scheduling, just basic merging? And, for example, what if your IO schedulers could cooperate between each other within a guest and within guests?
Across guests.
Mm. Wouldn't you have, I don't know.
Well,
there's something along those lines, by the way.
The one thing I can think of is the Parda work. You remember the distributed IO scheduling,
yeah.
which figure out how to adjust
the queue sizes. But I'm talking about something more para-virtual, like actual IO scheduler algorithms talking between each other.
Hmm. Even through the hypervisor. Hypervisor
yes.
is sort of
yes.
coordinating
yes.
a queue length inside the guest.
No, not queue length. The actual algorithms are talking between each other. It's a distributed algorithm.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be fully para-virtual, like.
Very interesting, yeah. I mean, certainly worth thinking more about.
So first you have to think about what are the problems with current solutions, right? Having a... Yeah,
I agree. I think right now, there was this paper at FAST. Was it FAST? Yeah, FAST. Where they had this... the study on evaluating stacked file systems. So file system running inside a guest and file system running inside the hypervisor, different types of file systems. They said, okay, what if I change the file system inside the guest and change the file system in the hypervisor, which is the best combination for certain workloads and that sort of stuff. So that's the only study that I'm aware of which is somewhat related to this direction. But what you're talking about is different, I know.
You could say algorithms work better with more information. So if they communicate and they coordinate across guest to hypervisor and across hypervisor, algorithms should be more efficient.
Yes.
Ideally, right?
Ideally, yes. So now that's what is a hypothesis. Okay, so what you've just described is a hypothesis. And for you to make that hypothesis, you should have some intuition behind why you think that hypothesis is likely to be true, right? And it seems like you have that. So the next step then is, okay, how do we go about evaluating this hypothesis, right? And this evaluating this hypothesis requires first coming up with concrete ideas as to how we're going to instantiate the hypothesis. I'm saying that, okay, with cooperation, the performance can be better. What kind of cooperation? It would make sense. And then once I instantiate the hypothesis, maybe several instantiations, I evaluate each instantiation separately. Right? So those are the logical steps if we want to go in that direction. And it makes sense for me to pursue that more.
One possibility, because it seems like when you are in the queue of the virtual machine, you send an IO, and then that IO is sent. But probably there is a chance to merge that IO with something else in the other virtual machines.
and it hasn't changed already. It hasn't submitted already.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can actually make one IO instead of four or whatever.
But what is the difference between doing it at that level and waiting for them to get to the
hypervisor
and then merging them?
Yeah, in that example, it would be the same. You have a longer queue. Instead of having your queue here, you have your queue here, and it's a large queue. In that case, you have that, but I was thinking about what else could happen.
Yeah, it's the same as having the queue.
Yeah. That example, yeah, you have that easy solution, but there has to be something else. And by the way, about what you were saying, right, I mean, about the queue size, you know, you should decrease the queue size because you have less queuing time and all that. We were actually thinking of the complete reverse direction, having very long queue sizes so the schedulers can do a better work, and that's what Salma was starting to work on. And one limitation for large queue sizes was that, for example, in Linux, every I/O that's in your queue comes already with an allocated page for buffering. So that's a limitation. You cannot have gigantic queue sizes because they have to be waiting with a page. So what if we have
and that page is locked.
And that page is locked. What if you didn't need that page to be locked and you have gigantic queue sizes?
Why do you have the page?
You have that. I mean, you don't need to have that page for start because you haven't started IO, right? But the way Linux is designed, that's the way it is.
The reason you need that page is that because you need to read. When you read data from the disk, you need to put it somewhere.
But you haven't started.
The point is that in Linux, before you submit the IO, you need to have that page allocated. But I guess what he's saying is that you don't actually need the page allocated, but you just need the IO in queue, and just before dispatching the IO, you allocate the page.
In Linux, the design error is that they use the page for all the locking, for example. The page has the state about whether this page is in the middle of an IO or not. And the problem is that this page comes with the actual page. You have this per frame.
Okay.
You say this frame is in the middle of an IO.
So for every request before actually this
dispatches, you have the frame, allocated frame.
So it does the mem set before, or does everything?
It's ready for being submitted.
Sorry, it's allocated.
Yes, yes. Okay. But you shouldn't have to, especially for a read. Yeah. But that is actually a second layer of indirection, right? You have pages not pointing. You have virtual frames now.
I think we need to know why that is the case. I would think that is that way because there is something we are missing. Something like IOs are submitted in the end IO handler, right? If that is the case, then we can allocate a page there.
Actually, you know, thinking even further, this idea of having virtual frames, it's actually good even for hybrid memory.
Yes.
That will be a different abstraction,
yes.
Right? You have virtual RAM that's not actually your virtual address space.
Yes.
So if you introduce this new abstraction of virtual frames, you can use it for this and this.
And this, yeah. And perhaps something else.
Yeah.
Like non-blocking writes.
Like non-blocking writes, yes.
Non-blocking writes, different queue sizes.
So how do you think about this abstraction? Having another virtual memory for... It's not that your application thinks that you have all the virtual memory. Your kernel itself thinks that you have virtual memory. So its frames are not real frames, virtual frames. Something like, you know, a hypervisor gives to a guest or something.
So that sounds very interesting. We have to motivate why an abstraction like that would be useful.
We have these two things, right?
So wait, where would you store the virtual frame? There, I have another idea, but I don't know. I'm just throwing it.
Okay.
Yeah. Throw many ideas. As many as you want. Is there any work about having thinner, let's say, in typical
virtualization environment, you have your guest, which you have your applications, and the application talks to the library or directly to the chemist, the system calls, and then you have a hypervisor and the actual hardware. Is there any work trying to make this thinner, let's say, move all this complexity down here in such a way that here you only have the applications and the libraries?
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody wants
that. All operating system.
Yeah,
that's one of my
that's one of my problems with virtualization.
By
that's
way.
What I was thinking.
Uh-huh.
That's actually a comparison, right? But
right.
Make the application aware of the other or the second block. And that's the same idea why we use virtualization, right? So because you want to isolate files and they ideally because you're gonna better utilize the physical hardware, I mean the hardware.
If the
operating system did what it's supposed to do, then we didn't have a need for virtualization, right? It's like a hack between us.
I guess, yeah. Well, that was the point of the processes, right?
Sorry.
The processes are supposed to be running alone.
Right.
And they are actually not, mm-hmm. and that's how in Unix you share hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Virtualization provides more than that.
Isolation.
It provides
portability.
Yeah, exactly. That's the word. So I can run any kind of operating system on top of a hypervisor.
Sure.
And applications, can use multiple operating.
True.
So the idea is that if you move this down here, then they could communicate and with the hypothesis that you had before, which makes sense. If you have more information, you can do other things.
Well, for instance, there have been people who have talked about building thin virtualization, where the operating system itself provides virtualization, but by simple isolation of the file system. Right? And maybe strict limits on physical memory.
But if you make a process portable, because, well, I mean, processes right now, I think in Unix, the problem is that there are too many interfaces to make it portable, right, to migrate, for instance, a process. But if you reduce that all the interfaces to a couple, I don't know, that can make the whole thing, then and make that process movable, let's say between machines or whatever, wouldn't that have most of the advantages of virtualization?
I think, yes, and I haven't thinking about it, and it doesn't even sound intuitive why it is harder to move a process than
exactly.
a complete machine.
Exactly. I think it's harder is because even though a virtual machine is more complicated, I think the interface is very narrow, right? And that's not true for a process, I think. But now, I think the problem with what I'm saying is that in the virtual machine case, you can run something that was running before. I have an old machine running Windows 95. And I can move that to a hypervisor, and it runs seamlessly compared to to what was doing before. And that you cannot do with this thin process I'm talking about. Right? That's by the way, it's a huge disadvantage.
One way, and I heard that at VMware, is to wrap the process in something else. For example, having Java threads.
Right.
A Java tool would be easier to migrate. So the interface that this OS guest provides is not a typical POSIX interface, would be the JVM.
Right.
And I remember there was a project like that. And it sounds nice, performance is great and everything, but it's who wants that single interface? You need, you have already your application, have databases and everything, and not everything has to be done in Java.
You have your operating system as well.
Yeah.
How about something like you compile the process in statically.
No, but that's not even the only issue. Right? You have network, you have
you
have the process
shaking
all over the place.
So what you're saying is that we can make you first compile it statically, so you don't depend on any library, and then there is a layer that provides all those small network and stuff and direct all those requests through a narrow thing.
So Gnosis calls?
Gnosis calls. Well, you can make a syscall through the same channel, right? Something like a request of a server.
We want to provide that instruction in those cases.
Sorry. You need something in the middle. Right?
Why?
Then it's it's the same as saying running all the processes on the same OS.
Yeah, you need to package the process in something nice and movable.
Right.
Who is doing this? The process itself, you think?
You have a lot of information in the package. You have
probably.
What is in calls for version of
the
library?
That's
probably a library.
For example,
has all
the,
that.
The machine is this nice package, right?
Right.
It could be a library.
Hmm.
Right? It could be a library. Just like, for instance, wine. What it does is create that package, right, for a Windows process that runs on Linux.
So you're saying a Wine process would be easier to migrate?
To any Linux machine.
Yes.
Yes.
But how this started? You say we don't need hypervisors and we argue against that.
I never liked the idea of hypervisors. Never. I know that it saves energy, but that's just because the operating systems are not good enough.
Yeah, I agree.
If the operating system were good enough, we didn't have virtualization. We didn't have a need for virtualization.
But virtualization is, you can see the whole thing as a single OS. You're just separating packets, right?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, that's the advantage. You can run your whole server in a virtual machine. That's cool.
Yeah, the thing is that operating systems come in many, many different flavors, right? Even Linux is packaged in so many different ways, and everyone and now you can argue that the cloud is a good thing or not, but running services in the cloud has been shown to be more economical than running things in your own data center. And so when you aggregate things, your diversity will increase further, right? And then you need a virtualization-like solution where you can pretty much run anything that you have to run at any point in time.
Right.
Those are some of the positives of virtualization.
Yeah, and I think that's really hard to replace.
You need an interface.
And if you continue on that logic, you shouldn't need OS. Why not run your process with a library compiled OS and you run directly on hardware?
I have to rewrite everything again.
No, because the one you're saying doesn't have isolation, for instance, it doesn't share hardware, right?
Well, if you trust your processes and they will behave nicely, why not?
No,
let's change the discussion to something.
Let's just make an
activation
that can handle processes
So another concrete example of revisiting existing OS design with new technologies, if you remember the Perl versus Interrupt paper, right? And they said, okay, IOs are much faster now, and does it make sense to continue to use an interrupt-based system? That's another example, right, of revisiting current design. And I think that's one direction. The other is the harder one, which is revisiting existing design for existing technology. That's the really hard one. And I think we were able to do that with a couple of projects, right, like the non-blocking rights work, where we said that it's really important to revisit this existing design or even existing technology. I think those sorts of ideas are very hard to come. But it's possible. I think the easier things to look at is, okay, how do existing or new technologies integrate into existing technologies, and what kind of software changes would make sense?
Something I've been seeing, you know, as years come by, is that we have more layers and more layers of everything, right? And that should be bad,
Well, that's what the MIT guys have been arguing for a very long time, right? With their exokernel and and a whole bunch of different projects where they say applications should tell the OS what to do. And that's certainly okay. So there is one approach where you say, okay, the current direction as dictated by the market, and which is not the right direction, and you say, okay, here's a brand new direction and we should all go towards that. And I think that's also risky. It may not be as risky as assuming a new technology exists and going after that, but it's somewhat risky again, because people are not going to give up what they're already doing completely and switch to something new because it's the right thing to do, right? Because they already have a lot of investment in the current technologies. And for research to have impact.
Yeah.
Okay, exokernel was a great idea. But does it have impact today?
No.
Okay, so you have to...
He got a job at MIT.
Yeah. Okay, so that was a single person impact. That's the kind of impact you're after.
No.
One person's career probably got a little better. Okay. That's not the kind of impact I'm talking
about.
So you have to evaluate that as well. I mean, it's not the ideal world, which we might all want to believe. But we have to work within the given the parameters of the problem. We have to work within those parameters.
Yeah, for example, you know, the very simplistic block layer with no information. I always hear it. And nobody wants to, you know, enrich that thing because that's the way it is, and that's really stone in heaven by God himself, so nobody will change it ever.
What do you mean?
The only thing I have seen that they have changed is the trim command.
Yeah.
They have made the block layer with the trim command.
No, but I'm talking about, for example, your block layer interface to the SAN, right?
Right.
You cannot say this block is more important, this block comes from here, this block is this block is that. You have block number and your operation, that's it.
It's not entirely true, because SCSI...
SCSI has some extensions. Yes.
Yeah. Extensions, and also even the basic command set has some additional information that you can supply.
Yeah, but I guess Vicara's point
but
is
it's
that...
it's not part
at
of the standard, so it's not working.
At the point... At
there
the point
is this paper in... I think SOSP 2011 called differentiated storage services,
yes,
where they explicitly talk about utilizing some of these SCSI extensions for specifying more semantic information about blocks.
And they specify that to whom?
To a storage system which has multiple types of devices,
right.
So you can store blocks in
to,
the right
to
place.
A black box of storage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before we conclude the session, I think we should spend some time talking about how we're going to use the hard disk that we have.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think that's easy. We have to put it in Elephant.
But we only have to replace one disk in Elephant.
Yeah. Also, there are two disks. Oh, we have three more. Okay.
We have four disks in total.
Oh, okay, cool. Didn't know that.
Well, are we, I think it's about time we concluded the session. Are there any other ideas before we go on to the disk-based, disk deployment question?
You know, I kind of have to, you know, clear off my ideas for them together.
Yeah, sure. Shouldn't we kind of summarize what the ideas, at least to analyze, I mean, to basically say if we are continuing that direction or not? For example, I like it, the butterface thing. That should be something simple to check if the overhead comes from checksumming and whether you can do quick checksumming using GPU.
Yeah. By the way, CFS does the same thing. they do checksumming of every block.
It's slow also.
Yes.
But I feel like that, I mean, that's, if we are ButterFS developers, I would say absolutely go for that. Right? But given that other people have already evaluated how much checksumming costs on a GPU versus a CPU, that question is already answered.
Okay.
So I don't
know. Okay.
From a research publication standpoint, I don't, at least given the limited discussion we've had, I don't see it as being publishable.
Okay, so that's not going through. What about coordination between schedulers and caches and all
that? I think that's promising, certainly promising. And
okay.
I also we talked about, you know, what the next step should be in that direction.
Okay.
If anyone is interested in pursuing this more, they should take that next step, and we can have more discussion afterwards. After you've had a chance to take that next step, to instantiate the hypothesis.
Yeah. I have an exam site.
Okay. Yeah. You should go.
Well, that's the ideas I've been proposing. What about your ideas? Well, actually, that was your idea. Okay.
Yeah.
All the other thing was this virtual frame thing, abstraction.
Virtual frame.
Yeah.
Yeah, for that, I think first we have to discuss motivation, right?
Okay.
At least intuitively there has to be some motivation, some good motivation for doing that. And
by the way, I haven't made it clear, but the implementation comes with the fact that you can fault accessing physical pages that don't exist. So we need extra hardware.
Or flag.
Or something, we need something from the hardware. Because at least that's the first option we tried with Luis. And turns out when you access physical frames that don't exist, you fault, and that's fine. But you don't get information about the physical stuff that you access. Which should be something very simple to do, but we don't have. Assuming that we have it, all these thing will be
I guess we kind of have it because even in the operating system, because we have
we can
the
access to instructions.
Virtual address. No, you have the virtual address and you have the page table.
Yeah, okay, so you have it. Okay.
But I think actually the problem was that it wasn't throwing the page fault. I think that was the problem.
No, it was throwing the page fault.
Okay.
That I remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know that the error is different, though. It's not a fault error, but it's more something like a bus error.
Yeah. Yes.
A bus error? Sounds dangerous. I mean, that could be any kind of error.
No, you have lots of flags. And assuming you didn't have it, you could.
Mm.
You could.
Right? Yeah.
Can you have those flags?
Let's say you own Intel.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
So the hypothesis is not as strong as saying that you have all the money in the world.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're improving. We're improving.
Yeah.
No, I think that's worth spending a little bit more time on in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Getting all the money in the world.
I'm working towards that. I have to win all the lotteries in the world. Maybe then I can buy some country and make it rich, and then I can buy the U.S. You know, start little by little. And then I can publish this.
Okay, anything else?
That's all from my side.
I talked about the hybrid memory in the hypervisor, but at this point I'm not clear exactly what to do there.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.